Okay, so hello. Welcome to the ADHD UK podcast. I'm Jamie.
And I am Max. And welcome. Yes, welcome, welcome all.
Welcome, welcome everybody. Today we are speaking to Dean from Big Heritage, a community interest company based in Chester. Big Heritage are an award-winning social enterprise connecting museums, schools and communities. I am really looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's a great chat. And we talk about Dean's beginnings as a boy in Birkenhead who's sort of growing up, producing messy work and getting kind of called out for it. Cool. Tramping around cemeteries with his family and getting bit by the kind of archaeology history bug. And then, just sort of mid-20s revitalization of his, after the birth of his first child, is sort of pulling himself up through real kind of determination to get a master's in the end in archaeology, a master's degree, and then set up Big Heritage and go through all of the kind of ups and downs of setting up a company and keeping it going for the last 15 years. It's a pretty amazing story, actually. I think it's told with real kind of humility as well. So I think we let Dean speak for himself and on with the show.
Yeah.
So welcome, Dean Patton, to the ADHD UK podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
No worries at all. Jamie's going to kick us off with our first question.
Oh, Dean, so when, can you tell me when you started to feel different then? When did it kind of click that there might be something there?
I think with hindsight, I can date it back earlier to things in childhood. Perhaps didn't notice they were different at the time, but I was, primary school was okay. It was quite studious. I was kind of vociferous as a reader, but really, really sloppy and scruffy with work and handwriting. My handwriting's atrocious now and disorganized with stuff. I actually remember one of those core memories that a teacher, not a particularly nice teacher in primary school, maybe stand up in class after I'd done a piece of work and had little smudges on and held it up and asked the class whether they thought it was a good enough piece of work. And there's only one guy, a good friend of mine, he's actually still a friend of mine, put his hand up and she tore the work up in front of me.
My goodness.
In front of the whole class. I think it was about eight. The only reason it's quite a core memory is my mum's a pretty tough old Birkenhead school mum, and I went home and told her, and she went down to the head teacher and said, if she does it again, I'll drag the teacher out and I'll ask all the parents in the playground whether she's a good enough teacher in front of everyone. I think she nearly got banned from the playground for a while after that. But so I think she's great. She takes no mess. I think challenge wise was high school, really, because you can breeze through primary school on a bit of wit and the first year or so, high school wasn't too bad. And then all of a sudden you have to then knuckle down, make an effort, coursework, etc. And then it just kind of, for me, school just went pretty much into free fall over that. So always work, always late or finishing off on the bus or half-baked subjects I was interested in. I was really, really focused on, or if a teacher was all right, and then the rest of that was just, but I think I went to high school from 95, so I was very much, it was still that kind of naughty boy syndrome then. It wasn't really, I think ADHD had obviously been recognised, but still nothing like it is today. So GCSEs went great, and then I didn't manage to make A-levels. I started them, and then I didn't get kicked out of the school, but I think they politely said they should leave, which I effectively did. So that was what, age 17, 18. And then I kind of job wise just flitted for a few years. All my friends had gone to university, and I set up a couple of businesses ranging from trying to import wheelchairs from China, which started out okay for the first few months. And then I realized I was meant to reinvest the money in the business and not being frivolous, drinking it type of thing. And then it was worked in a few bars and my level of kind of commitment to any one cause, you know, jumping from one thing to the next was having an effect. And it was my diagnosis was a bit strange because I was going through these kind of like depressive times and then like hyperactive time, bouncing around with ideas. And then I'd gone to the doctors and they started, in fact, actually diagnosed me with bipolar disorder.
Oh, right.
I was convinced it was based around these ups and downs. Yeah. And I can't remember what I started reading into ADHD. And I sort of self-diagnosed in a sense as I went back to the doctors. And what I realized I was doing is I was coming out with these big ideas and running with them for a while. They were just going nowhere. Then I was just plummeting into a depression because
I
was getting into a load of debt and things weren't working. And I realized these peaks and troughs weren't kind of chemically imbalanced peaks and troughs. They were just natural. You've messed up, so now you're feeling down about it.
That's so interesting.
Disappointed. Yeah. And then, you know, you bounce back up again and you do something else. And then it became quite clear. It's funny, a good friend of mine's wife's a lecturer in pharmacology, and we had a chat about Christmas. He said, you need to come speak to my pharmacy students because that's such a interesting case of this diagnosis. When on the surface of it, it kind of makes sense. So then, I got a proper diagnosis, I think 28. And then I'd waited a long while and I went through all the tests from the little ping pong ball on your head through to all the kind of self surveys, and it was just cut and dry. And what was really good for me in the sense is that the GP I was going to had a young GP who was starting to branch and specialize in adult ADHD. So I think it became a bit of a test case experiment.
Yeah,
case
for that's always handy.
It was, and I was quite open about, and because I was reading a lot around it myself and saying, look, I think this is happening. She was almost making notes and learning as she went along, but just having someone a bit more open-minded to it was like literally life-changing, really. So that's how that kind of come about. So I didn't actually, you know, career-wise, certainly my life didn't kick off until I was probably like 20. My eldest daughter was 23, who's now 19, but not until after that did they actually get into the career path that I'm in now. So I went kind of back to the beginning and kind of restarted, if you like.
The restart and the start of Big Heritage, which is your company, that started around the time.
I'm still stuck at the ping pong ball, though. Like, I really need to know about this.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah,
sorry, we need to go back to the ping pong ball.
Oh, sorry, yeah, I'm assuming really keep the ping pong
ball. Very good point. Max. Shall I come in at this point and explain what that is?
Yeah, better than I do, yeah.
So that is the QB test. And the ping pong ball has probably been superseded. That sort of dates you a little bit as to you went through the diagnostic process. But I also had a ping pong ball in my head, not for the diagnostic, but at the time I was working.
Ping pong ball, exciting.
I was actually working in Reading, diagnosing ADHD, and we were one of the first areas to have the QB. The QB is it's a continuous performance test. I describe it sometimes as the world's most boring video game. It's sort of, you have to click at some points and not click at some points, and you have to concentrate on, it is painfully boring. I almost think it's most useful. its greatest utility is how unpleasant people find it. People with ADHD find it very, very, very unpleasant because it is so dull. But it does also glean some useful information. It's slightly taken over in a way that's not terribly helpful because it's not actually as accurate as the manufacturers claim, but that's what it is, if that makes sense.
Oh, whoa, that's like, and like, and when
ping-pong,
did this
the ping pong ball on the head is tracking your head movements. So the more you move your head, the more hyperactive it thinks you are.
When did that stop?
That basically when tracking software improved, so you didn't need the ping pong ball, you just tracked the whole head.
I think it was like an Xbox head controller or something originally.
Oh, really?
Could have been, yeah.
You have like a small target, and then the closer your little dot is to the target, the more you can focus. And
a very old version then, yeah.
Yeah, well, I stood up halfway through in the end because I couldn't focus. And she's like, yeah, I think we'll just finish that one. I nearly ticked the ping pong ball test.
Honestly, I need to find some stock video, stock footage of that to put in the background of a rave or a club or something like that. That sounds fun.
Yeah, I'm feeling really old now, so it's dated me, but yeah, it kind of did.
Sorry about that. I mean, you're not as old as I am.
Yeah, I did. That was not my intention.
Some comfort there.
But yeah, so that was, and then in terms of the great reset, if you like, is actually when my daughter was born, and I was working in a bar, and then I took over to manage another bar, which was Adapt Me. It was in a fairly cushy like private members club, and then I ambitiously got offered the brewery office to manage me this own pub, which was just like this really rough social club, fights and people getting beaten up on drugs, and it was like, I can't believe I took this on, managed it, and coming home at silly o'clock not seeing my daughter, and I was like, I need to go back. And I'd had so many different career changes and failures in like the last 4 or 5 years. I was like, right, if I'm going to do it, especially because I've got my daughter, what did I enjoy doing? Like, what do I love in life? And I'll go back and do that. And, you know, it's fairly naive, really. But when I was younger, well, all through my life, I've just been really passionate about history, archaeology, ancient history, local history. And when I was growing up, we used to go, I mean, the joys of probably with hindsight, because growing up, not much money, you go to museums and old cemeteries and churches because they're all free, so it just kind of was embedded in me, really. So I was like, do you know what, I want to go back. And I think I had a chip on my shoulder as well about not having qualifications, and all my friends had graduated from uni and everything else, because I knew, you know, I thought I'd be capable of getting a degree, but I felt like, you know, obviously wasn't capable at getting onto the course. So I went back and done an access course and went to Chester University to do archaeology. And it was one of those degrees at the time where it's only so many hours a week, you know, in terms of lectures. So I got a full-time job working at an autistic centre, kind of residential home, still managed to do a full-time degree course because there was only so many hours committed. So weeknights. And then I just found my niche and, was really, really driven. I was classed as a mature student. And I remember at the time thinking, am I too old to go back to uni? And I think it was 23. You know, you think, God, just sounds a baby, ridiculous, isn't it? 23. And I just kind of fell in love with learning. Then I was at the front of the class. And I know I'm kind of throwing some kind of ADHD cliches in there, but that hyper-focused stuff, because I was really interested in landscapes and maps and, you know, reading the work. So I'd sit and look at old tide maps for hours and hours of the night time and start picking out things and patterns that people hadn't picked up before. And so I flourished at Chester Uni because it was, you know, it wasn't like this big red brick university, but they had some really great understanding lecturers, and you know, they gave back what you put in. So I ended up getting a first class honours degree there, and then there was a professor. The area, my kind of academic area of interest, like the early medieval kind of 8th to 11th century in the Northwest. And there's a professor called David Griffith, who's from similar area from Wirral as I am. And he was a professor at Oxford University. So I'd done my dissertation, won a prize around the same interest of study as him. So then I ended up getting a 2 years master's course at the University of Oxford, which is quite a jump from not getting any A levels. So it's a kind of professional master's. And that's when the kind of concept for Big Heritage came from there. And I think the irony was we're doing a lot of field work down in Oxford, and it was in like Dorchester-on-Thames, all these really beautiful.
Yeah, Dorchester-on-Thames is particularly beautiful.
It is lovely, but we were doing field work in this lady's garden, and she happened to have like a medieval chapel in a garden. And, you know, you're like, I had a wheelie bin or something in my garden. I was like, this is not, you know, normal life up in the Northwest. And I was trying to work out how I could make archaeology specifically at the time more accessible for young people from my background, where I was from. And I basically set Big Heritage up as a vehicle to try and make that more accessible. And there was a a different type of archaeology called test pitting. So rather than these huge, big, massive trenches, you do tiny, small 1 meter trenches, and you'd do 30 or 40 of these rather than one big one. And then you could start analyzing finds data. So you chart the pottery and, you know, little sherds of pottery. And for example, Bromborough, an area started working on, you could see that after the Black Death, it kind of really died off, but then really shot back up. And a lot of villages after the Black Death disappeared, where some of them flourished because there's a bit of a kind of trade boom afterwards. And so we could chart these unknown bits of local archaeology, but you were digging in like a pub garden or on a grass verge or a roundabout, and we were getting local people to do the digging with us, children and everything else there. And I say we, it was kind of me and one other person at the time, and it was just an unbridled success. We got some funding from Heritage Lottery Fund, and that was the kind of the impetus and the beginning of it, really, back in 2011. And then, well, fast forward. So what happened was we carried on growing and still doing these kind of project by project, and a lot of them were grant funded. And then we realized we do a great project, the grant comes to an end, you've got to go back to the beginning or start something new. It was a really unsustainable method of doing what we wanted to do. So we started looking at ways of generating our own income, which certainly within Heritage is obviously tourism and, you know, attractions that people be prepared to pay to get into. And at the time, we'd run a project with Wellcome Trust, obviously a big medical charity, and we'd done a project around the history of Roman medicine and, you know, the science of ancient medicine, and but also the kind of the blood and guts and gore of horrible histories-esque stuff that, you know, kids find interesting. So we opened what we thought was going to be a pop-up museum called Sick to Death in Chester, and took on an old building, set up a little museum that we thought would last 6 months. And that's 10 years old this year, and I think it's the busiest ticketed attraction in the city centre in Chester. And that approach meant we could charge people to come in, pay wages, pay the lights, pay the rent, and reinvest any surplus. And then we took some risks. So we took on then a second place, Western Approaches, which was at the time derelict underground bunker in Liverpool, but is, you know, the most, you know, one of the most important Second World War sites in the world, and command center of the Battle of the Atlantic, and 50,000 square feet underground of concrete and steel, and ridiculous risk at the time to take that on. But now again, that's our flagship. You know, huge amount of visitors, recognized, you know, a lot of work with the Royal Navy, and you know, I think it's the highest rated museum in Liverpool on TripAdvisor, which is no mean feat, because it's some fantastic.
No, because it's got some pretty hefty competition in Liverpool.
And they're all free. We've got a charge, you know what I mean? So we do well to get that. And it's kind of grown from there, and it's kind of snowballed into its own little industry. A lot of museums we're not for profit, and we reinvest either in projects that we found really interesting that we wouldn't normally get funding for. For instance, we're working with Clatterbridge Cancer Centre at the moment on a veterans, Navy veterans project around prostate cancer, which is a bizarre thing to say that we do, but we can kind of help fund stuff like that. Or we reinvest into growth. So we are technically, well, there's only kind of private owners of a German U-boat in the world, which is not something I thought.
Yeah, how does that happen? let's unpack how you managed to end up.
How do you get a U-boat? Honestly, it is, I think my brother said, it's the most ADHD story you can ever tell, being is that you've accidentally got a U-boat.
How did that happen?
So, well, look, shortening the story, there's only four U-boats left in the world. One was captured by the Americans and is now on display in Chicago. There's two still in Germany. And then in 1993, there was one U-boat that refused to surrender at the end of the war, tried to escape, and they sank it. But because it wasn't a war grave, no one died on board it. They raised it in 1993 on the assumption that it was full of gold, and that's why it was trying to escape, but it wasn't, long story. So then the Danish donated it to a what was a a ship, historic ship charity in Birkenhead. Then that went bust, and the local authority runs the ferry operation in Merseyside, took it on, bought it for £1, took it on and created a museum at one of their ferry terminals, which closed during COVID. And so the Battle of the Atlantic is effectively Western Approaches was the Battle of the Atlantic Command Center. And then this U-boat, which is on the other side of the River Mersey, was that other side of the story. And it kind of slowly become anonymous, really. And we wanted to kind of basically take it on and revitalize it. So we literally said, can we have your U-boat? Pretty much in them.
Have you got any U-boats lying around that we might have?
Yeah, well, it's the only one knocking about, and we took that on about 2-3 years ago, and we've got about £6.5 million new Battle of the Atlantic museum that's being built on that site as we speak now. So it's due to be completed by early summer next year, which is the only dedicated Battle of the Atlantic museum in the world. We've got the US Navy, Canadian Navy, Royal Navy, all kind of endorsing it and all on board with it. And obviously, we've got a plane there as well, a Grumman Avenger U-boat killer, basically bomber, which we'd acquired. But yeah, that's the only U-boat of its kind. It's I should tell people I've got a private yacht. It sounds a bit more...
That's interesting, I think.
Yeah, put it on your Tinder profile that you've got a private yacht, and she turns up and it's a rusty
yacht. And it's a rusty old U-boat.
Yeah, that's where we're at now. And I think we've got about 35, 40 staff or something across all the sites. And I'm in the position now where I go and do the silly stuff, like ask people if they want to give us the U-boat and a few other daft adventures along the way. And the team I've got surrounded me after years of getting the wrong people or people who just didn't get how I needed to operate. And I've got a really small but really loyal and understanding and very, very capable team who fill in the gaps where I've just got to the point where I don't beat myself up about stuff and rubbish at anymore. And just I've brought in people who are better than I am. And it seemed to have worked well.
Because I think that brings us to one of our other questions, doesn't it, Jamie?
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess at what point did you realise this is time? I need to sort of outsource some of the things that I'm not so good at to other people. Was there a moment? Or
I think there was a specific moment. I think so. I'd had people, obviously, since kicking off in 2011, the staff that have come and go, and there has been times where I've kind of gave away a lot of control to people. So there's once or twice I've had people come to work who I don't know what is the opposite of someone with ADHD, but you know what I mean? They're very anal, very detailed and this, that and the other. And certainly the last time I did that, I kind of, in some sort of shame, gave them so much of control of running stuff because I was like, I can't do this. And there was a bit of that of guilt on my part of like, gosh, I'm running this company out and I'm useless at it. And it went the other way, it become very vanilla and dull. I was kind of blocked out of some decisions, even though it was my company in that sense. And that ended fairly acrimoniously. I just thought then, do you know what? I'll live with the stuff. I'll live with the filing things later, live with the forgetting to pay bills on time and this sort of thing, because actually the essence of what the company is and how it should be run and the fun and the kind of zeal about it is more important than like paying the bills on time. And I know there's probably people out there rolling their eyes, but paying bills on time is just what you just should do. It's fine. And within reason, anyone can do that. But what my skill set was just thinking a bit differently about things, taking a bit of a risk, being a bit more playful and moving away from what a traditional kind of museum would be. And I thought, I literally stopped beating myself up over it and go, do you know what? I'm never going to be that person. My, you know, kitchen doors get left open as piles of clothes on the floor. You know, from a personal perspective, it is what it is. It really was that moment where it's like, I had to get control. I had to kind of make sure things were in order, but in a way that I wanted to do, and also just not worry if things, things are late. They're late, and if you don't want to work with us because we're scatty, then fine. But there's, you know, we're flying. But the team I've got around me now just know what I'm like, and I know there's decisions and stuff now they don't bother me with, or there's HR problems, and they just don't tell Dean because he'll deal with it differently, and I'm grateful for the way that is. But and likewise, they appreciate, which is important, that you know what I do is you know adds so much. So it's a long journey, and I think there's loads of times along the way it could have gone wrong, or you know we've made so many mistakes along the way, but you know either fortune or effort, we're kind of thriving and doing really well. And I think just that embracing that neurodiversity of anything is an asset. I think it's a bit slightly cliche where people say, "Oh, it's a superpower," and you get all because it's
yeah.
This time it just kills me. And I think no, it's horrible. But there are certainly in business, and I know there's a kind of correlation with entrepreneurship of that kind of thinking differently, and also taking the risk is a big one. But there's so many risks I've taken have just backfired, and I go, "Oh my God, can't believe!" And you don't tend to. People don't tend to tell you those kind of horror stories, but there's been so many of them. You know, it's been a slog. But yeah, so the company's kind of ebbed and flowed as I have personally, and mental health and everything else. But yeah, it's been fascinating because it's a little niche. There's no other real museum group that's not kind of paid for by the government or the council or taxpayers. We're fairly unique in that sense, but we're doing all right, and I'm just completely and utterly unemployable outside of this. Like I would not employ me. I would absolutely not employ me in a million years. So I just long may survival continue, so I don't end up on the dole.
That is interesting, isn't it? That how much of the museum sector is basically an arm of the state in some way.
Yeah, so
what you're saying in some sense.
Yeah, and I think it should. I mean, for me, in the UK, every so many museums are free. Either it's the local authority that pay for them, like a council. For instance, the Grosvenor Museum, Chester, close to us, is funded by council taxpayer. Or your national museums, which are effectively government funded, and I think that's important. You know, I would say free museums are great, but there is a weird side. You know, you go abroad, you go to Rome, and I'll pay to go into any museum abroad. And in this country, I don't know whether there is an element of value. So, you know, you'll pay 10 quid to get into a museum and you'll moan about it and go, "Oh, 10 quid. But then you'll go and have two gin and tonics that are 14 quid each, you know, after the museum, and you'll neck one in 10 minutes and have another one. And that seems fine. But 10 quid to spend 2 hours around a museum. I think it's just because we naturally don't pay for museums across the board.
We're just used to it, and therefore, to an extent, we don't value them. We could just go in there.
Yeah, I think it's...
Because it's raining and you want to be in the dry, rather than because you actually value the experience.
Yeah, it is a sense of value, but you know, equally as well, you know, Western approaches, it's kids don't basically pay to get in. We fund all that as well. So it is important, that, especially in the Northwest, in those areas that we're not... So Western approaches is quite similar to the Imperial War Museums, the Churchill's War Rooms, same experience, bunker underground. Ours is actually bigger. But I think theirs is like, I know it's in central London, but it's about four times the price for a ticket to get in. So
it is, it's pricey, that one.
We've got to pay the bills and everything else, but we are mindful of making sure it's, you know, accessible.
Well, I think you need, I suppose you think of yourself, and you said as growing up, you would go to museums and churches and cemeteries.
Oh, 100%. It was very formative. So I am conscious of that. And we do a lot of, certainly with schools, et cetera, where we do a lot of pro bono work and put back in where it's quite Robin Hood, especially if you look at Western approaches, you'll get Americans coming off, you know, £15,000 cruises, and they'll come to Liverpool because their dad was in the Second World War, you know, the Battle of the Atlantic, and they're absolutely enamoured to pay whatever the charge is. And you know, you've just paid 15 grand to cruise, like 10, 15 quid for tickets, it's nothing. And they'll spend a fortune in the gift shop, and often, you know, come out spending hundreds by the end of it, and that allows us to kind of make sure the kids, you know, are a quid or something to get in for everyone else. So yeah, it's and you know, we see tens and tens of thousands of school kids who come directly with schools every year as well. So it's yeah, it's quite a varied organisation.
I suppose I'm thinking about your ADHD and your relationship with failure, because it sounds like, because this doesn't feel like a sort of typical CEO podcast interview, although I haven't listened to that many of them, but you seem quite relaxed about failure, about there will be future failures, there have been past failures. Do you think that your relationship with failure and your relationship with your ADHD is a similar process?
I must admit, like, I don't, a lot of the terminology I'm not always akin to or really tuned in, but I know I suffer really badly with, like, imposter syndrome, and there are still times where I'm like, what am I doing in this? Like,
yeah,
this is, and I think that is obviously reflective of kind of past experience in childhood, and you know, a thousand times I've been told, you know, negative things. I think I've started to learn a lot more about that as I've got a bit older, but I think it's that the failure thing for me is I fail at loads of other stuff, and maybe I'm fairly tenacious and just get on with it, or maybe I'm just oblivious and I've just carried on. But I think I always, especially when you hear, like, you listen to some kind of podcast, the CEO stuff, it's a bit like Instagram. Everyone loves sharing the best things that they go on.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
No one's honest about the rubbish stuff. And then, so, you know, you look at people on Instagram and go, oh my God, their life's perfect, because they don't post it when they're crippled with anxiety and stuff like that. So everyone else just thinks, oh, my life's terrible compared to theirs. And so I'm just not honest about it. Like, we've done loads of stupid stuff, like, you know, projects and all this. Tell you what we nearly did wrong, and glad we pulled out. Sick to death is we revitalized it, got this new site in 2019, and it took us 6 months. We had the plague doctor as this great kind of character, and we were thinking of this stunt to relaunch it to the public, and there was this little virus that was kicking about in China at the time called COVID.
All right.
We were getting the news a little bit about it, and I said to Rob, who's the manager there, I said, tell you what we'll do, we'll get some of that biohazard tape for the day before, and we'll do a bit of a funny stunt and pretend it was like some virus has come to sick to death, and it'll be absolutely hilarious and people will love it. And then I can't even remember why, we just thought, no, let's just see how this plays out.
A global, devastating global pandemic that kills millions.
Yeah, you know, you look back and go, yeah, that was a good one, we swear. Yeah. We bought the tape and like a biohazard suit. Oh, yeah. In a lockup somewhere, but you know, and you think sometimes, yeah, that might have been the...
That could have been
that. Yeah,
that's death. So that was a near failure, But yeah, I think for every, you know, we do some brilliant stuff, but there's 10 things that we try and they don't quite work. And, you know, some of them aren't massive, but, you know, you give it a whirl and everything else. But I think what I do get with, which is kind of typical kind of ADHD kind of symptom, is bouncing to new ideas and coming up with new ideas. And I have 100 of them. And because I'm in the position now, work-wise, where I'm fairly free with my time to go and do that and pursue different things, I do have to rein that in. And I bring them back to this kind of senior leadership team, and some of them will go, okay. And then the others will go, well, that's stupid, but he'll have forgotten that, like, in a couple of days type of thing. But then some will run with, and they work out, you know, great. It's just... yeah, you know, we've had our own gin. We've got a clothing brand that's going to be launched soon, which I think will be actually quite good fun. But there's been plenty of things that we get wrong. So I'm quite open and honest about that, because it's part of the learning experience, really.
I find it kind of interesting that you said you've got your own gin and a clothing brand. So you're clearly doing quite a lot to make, you know, heritage kind of fun. And I mean, if you think about, a lot of heritage sites are often framed as something that's quite rigid, in academic spaces, which, you know, by definition would probably put a lot of people who are ADHD off. Do you do anything? Is there any measures that you take to make the heritage sites fun for, you know, children who might have ADHD?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're going to sick to death, I mean, it is just, it's like a playground of nice. History of medicine. There's a flying toilet machine that you can sit in called the TARDIS, which is like a visual. that was one of my favourite ones, that one. There's plague doctor flying around. There's dirty undies hanging that with germs that you can use spotlights, and the whole thing is insane. In fact, it maybe go the too far the other way to some extent. What was useful though is that I got a really good grounding when I was certainly when I was at Chester University with the that was my first real kind of understanding of academia and peer reviewing and understanding, because there's a lot of nonsense in history. It's the same with science, you know, a lot of idiotic science on the internet where people don't understand what peer review means and how something becomes, you know, published, etc. So
yeah,
I got that really good grounding at the first degree with some great lectures there. And so what we've always done is embed that first. So there's nothing factually incorrect at any of our sites by any stretch of the imagination. We can reference, you know, if there's something mentioned on an interpretation board, we'll give you the academic reference to back it up. But if we choose to do that by a flying poo across the sky, then that's fine. But
yeah,
we can draw that back. So we've kind of flipped it the other way around. I don't really say the word museum often for one of our sites because they're very kind of interactive and hands-on and more of experiences than they are museums, but using the past as a touchstone and for learning. So Sick to Death's brilliant because we do tackle some really interesting subjects. So there's a big wall of shame there. There's loads of the doors that you open and it's kind of debunking medical myths from, I don't know, Gwyneth Paltrow's vagina candle. We've actually got one in there. You can see Donald Trump drinking bleach through to...
Right. I mean, you've got the whole RFK. He's got his own wall of shame, all of his own, hasn't he?
Well, yeah, we maybe need to update it with him. Yeah. But we actually planned and built all that just before COVID came in, and it was so pertinent when we did, because then all of a sudden we had these kind of people trying to argue what, you know, the efficacy of vaccines and, you know, then linking vaccines back to autism and all the nonsense that goes with that. So we're, you know, for us it was great because actually we're talking about history through the, you know, the development of vaccines and Jenner and everything else, but we can use that as in a modern sense to kind of push home it, as best we can to the public what is the scientific process, what's the scientific method. You know, Galen of Pergamon was practicing this back in the first, second century when he was testing, repeating the test, see if it happened again. And like a famous one where he found that he vivisected a pig and showed that the laryngeal nerve controlled the voice by, you know, pinching this nerve and the pig stopped squealing and opened it again. And so we talk about that because it's the, you know, the baby steps of science and the scientific method.
Yeah,
so it's
experimentation and observation.
Yeah, it's not quite comparable to modern medicine, but it's that, you know, Vesalius dissecting bodies and proving things by viewing and observing. So, I know we're kind of going off on a tangent now, but it's not just history, really. It's that kind of crucial skills. And especially if people don't go and study a science at university, you'd be surprised that people don't know what peer review means and how, you know, science can kind of brings it back to ADHD and medication and everything else. The whole point of science is to potentially prove a theory wrong because it helps you advance.
Yes, it's to falsify.
Do you have any, you know, ADHD history information up there?
Do you know what? We don't. We have. That's a really good point. I'm personally fascinated about, and I still think there's a lot of work to be done on it. Quite interested in like human evolution of ADHD, and I know there's like the whole farmer hunter theory, which I don't think is quite right, but it is interesting that it for me, I just as a personal, I think the Industrial Revolution is what caused so many problems because making people sit at a school desk.
And
we've done a transport project recently, and people don't realize that like clocks and watches, you know, like the time to the minute only happened because of the railway system. So when railways came in, we needed to leave at this time and arrive at that time. And it blows people's mind that before the steam train, no one had a watch because you didn't need to, you know, you meet me when it, you know, just before dawn, or, you know, between the hours of 1 and 2 or whatever. And I think that's really interesting with ADHD actually, is because the parameters that we set for certainly the kids in school sat down so many hours a day that they're absolute, you know, millisecond of human evolution where that is necessary. And even agriculture's, you know, we humans kind of farming and staying in the same places just so modern compared to kind of the long durée of evolution. The human brain's, what, you know, maybe 300,000 years, it's been exactly the same. So yeah, maybe we should put, sorry to answer your question, absolutely. I mean, we should put something into that about ADHD. I guess I'd have to maybe kind of defer to ADHD UK to pull in some kind of current up-to-date science on it and help us with us. In fact, that sounds like I'm off on a project already.
Right. I think it is interesting. I think that all of this evolutionary biology of neurodiversity is very speculative. You know, there's all sorts of, you know, what the meaning, the evolutionary meaning of autism and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I think, you know, it speaks to the fact that so much of the difficulty of ADHD is a lack of fitness, lack of fit between the person's brain and their environment. And if you can have that at an individual level, but also you can blow that up to a population level, that we are living in an environment and a culture that a good proportion of people don't fit in with, can't fit within the expectations of the culture. And that is a broader societal question of whether we should be more accommodating to people who don't fulfill the expectations. To go back to your original story, your original anecdote, you know, when somebody holds up a piece of work in front of a class and say, is this a good piece of work? For me, the answer is, well, have you read it? You know, I don't care what it looks like. Have you read it? Or, you know, how do we look at a piece of work and see what the different virtues of it are? Does it look nice? Does it read well? Is it funny? Is it made on is it made with nice paper or on a nice pen? I don't know. Anyway, I don't know where that's going, but I think it's partly what we value about people as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. As I say, I don't actually think she'd read the content of what it was. Maybe the content was terrible. I don't know, but the point
is... Yeah, it works for the anecdote. The content was brilliant. So let's stick with that.
It was fantastic. It was, but the point was, the judgment was on the presentation when it was a piece of written work and it's not the content. And I think you're right. It's that kind of, you know, it's like that judge a fish how it climbs a tree, and it's not, you know, it's not going to be any good type of thing. And I think... you're right about the society thing, because at some point you've got to fit in to some systems. We can't just be anarchy, and you can't just kind of say I'm not doing it. Because but like, I think society just changes, especially with the internet and social media, has brought people closer in different ways. That there are new like mental health issues and neurodiverse conditions that are coming across. Certainly around like the likes of anxiety and stuff, which are far more prevalent and or more visible now, or maybe people are just communicating and talking more about them now. But it's how they fit in, as you say. It's what was a fit, because, you know, I've travelled all over the world and the depths of Ethiopia with a tribe, and ADHD didn't exist with their kids there because they were just running around busy. And so what a surprise, no one had ADHD and no one had depression, because they had to get out of bed and do their stuff anyway. It's I think society makes these things, and we make the society as well. So I think it's not the disparagement of any conditions, but I think these conditions are exacerbated or a torch is shone on them by the rules that we've got to follow, which is...
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
I think, shall we draw ourselves to a close? Because we've started to speculate wildly. Do you have any other questions, Jamie? Do you anything else you wanted to cover with Dean?
I think that was quite in-depth, to be perfectly honest with you.
I suppose I wanted to hark back to the story, the question we used to ask all the time when we used to do Extraordinary Brains, me and Tess. What are your hopes for the future, both for yourself, for your company, for ADHD people in general?
So I think I've reached a kind of mental limit in terms of expansion. We've got a couple of other new big projects we've finished, and then I'm going to take a break. For me personally, I've got loads of ideas and other things that I want to pursue that are not necessarily heritage related as well. So I'm going to get to a point, and I'm always handing over a lot of the big stuff to the staff and explore some new projects abroad. I was out in Kabul in Afghanistan in January working, doing some basic stuff around museums and education there, which was fun. And again, in Ethiopia, there's a project I want to look at doing some work in. But my main thing, and that the biggest joy of having a company run myself, is I've always picked the kids up from school. I've always dropped them off from school. You know, people who are entrepreneurial, run a business, you go, what's the advantage? And they go, oh, we can... money, this, that, and the other. Mine is I'm the dad outside the school gate, and my youngest daughter's come up to six. And so my aim is just, you know, whether I have any more kids or not, is just, you know, be the dad at the school gate. It's a very boring ambition to somebody.
No, not at all.
It's the best of what life's all about. In terms of wider ADHD thing, part of the reason I'm kind of motivated to come on and speak to you guys is I think, you know, when you kind of look back at yourself when you're, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, 11, I'd love to go back and give myself a pat on the shoulder and go, actually, it's just this, it'll be sound, and there's ways of coping with it. And I think we've come on so well collectively, you know, in the medical industry and everything else, that it's so fantastic. But I think I'd also love to kind of do some kind of pro bono voluntary work of being that, like, pat on the shoulder for some, especially young lads. I've got a 14-year-old son who's upstairs. I would hate to be a teenage boy at the moment, growing up in Britain. You're getting battered from pillar to post for, you know, everything, and really bad role models and everything else. So I think I'd like to kind of lend some time and kind of give for better or worse, my experience, and help some other people kind of maybe have a bit less of a rockier early start than I did, really. So some of the work you guys are doing, for instance, would probably sign me up as an extra volunteer type of thing, because I think it's
fantastic
advocacy and sharing. So yeah, I really appreciate the work you guys are doing, and this is probably like one of the first steps of coming on this podcast, so I thought I can share some wisdom.
It's been fantastic. Absolutely,
we're
fantastic.
Always looking for ambassadors, so you know,
and
hit me up, come and hit me, your Lauren up, and we'll
or pop up and you can come and sit in the U-boat and we'll have a chat.
Oh, that sounds...
I'll definitely
come and look at you. Yeah, I'll be into that.
At some point.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. So, Dean Patton, thank you very much for joining us on the ADHD UK podcast. That's it for now. Bye-bye. So, I really enjoyed that. What was the thing that really stood out for you, Jamie?
I really liked the invitation to come and hang out on the U-boat, to be perfectly honest.
That was a highlight.
I mean, I didn't actually know what a U-boat was until the conversation, and then I Googled it and I thought, oh my Lord, firstly, I need to find out what, I need to do a deep dive on U-boats, and secondly...
No pun intended.
Exactly.
Very good.
And secondly, like, I want to go hang out on that boat. So, like, I hope it wasn't an empty promise.
Well, I hope so too. Otherwise, we'll send some ADHD UK enforcers around. Not the
could
danger.
Have like a we could have a party on it, couldn't we? Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
No, I thought it was great. I mean, the U-boats are fascinating. It's interesting because they're both terrifying to be around in the sea and also be inside. I find that fascinating because they're such a terrifying machine of warfare, and had such an impact on the course of the war. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, I suppose it's probably good that Dean and I didn't get into the kind of details of the War of the Atlantic, but it's a fascinating story.
You know, we could do a separate one.
There are other podcasts that will tell the story of the War of the Atlantic better than this one. That was great. I mean, I can't get past the story of his mum. When the teacher pulled him up.
I love that. When she's I'm going to if that teacher does that again, I'm going to bring that teacher out into the playground and get all the kids to see if this is a good teacher. Oh, I love that.
And it's such poetic justice, and it usurps the kind of power dynamics of what was going on, because that was a humiliation. That was obviously quite an important memory for him, because it's quite humiliating. It's quite traumatic.
It's horrible.
Probably.
It's horrible.
And it's a sort of thing that's, I mean, I found very quite moving, because it's the sort of thing that not quite as extreme as that, but sort of happened to me. And I think it's definitely, I think as ADHD people, it forms our sense of ourselves as somehow broken, somehow not good enough.
I've got a similar story as well. And you remember it. You remember it, you know?
Yeah. And just not being, finding things as easy as other people. And it's sort of it's the feeling slightly out of place and a bit wrong is almost the thing you always get from ADHD stories if you dig under the hood, really, even people who've been very successful, as Dean has. And so I thought that's why I pulled him back up on the thing about failure, because he's very different to most CEOs you talk to.
Absolutely.
In the way that he speaks.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's certainly... there's like a sort of sense of almost like self-awareness. I don't know if that's even the right words, but like, he certainly, it was a great chat. It was an interesting chat for sure.
And you may get him as an ambassador. And of course, you may get some of our listeners who might be inspired to be ambassadors as well. Who knows? We might get some ambassadors out of this. They are the lifeblood. They are the lifeblood of the organization, the ambassadors. So if you want to join the lifeblood, our lifeblood, that sounds a bit weirder than it may.
That's a bit cultish, isn't it?
We're not a cult. ADHD UK, not a cult. anyway, but what we are is a charity. So if you have enjoyed this episode or any of the podcasts we've put out for the last couple of years, bear in mind we don't have Patreon, we don't charge, we don't advertise. Mm. So the only source of income is the charity itself. And if you want to give any back, please go to adhduk.co.uk/donate or just Google it, of course, which is what everyone will do, and give us some money. Not me, not Jamie, but the organization, ADHDUK, which, like Big Heritage, has grown from a tiny, teeny, it was not really my idea, but Henry's idea, to a great big successful thing, but always needs more support in a very tough environment. So please do go to the website and drop some virtual coins in the tin.
Even just £1 is
100%
invaluable.
100%. If everyone just gives a pound, who listens to this episode,
exactly that.
But I'm not going to tell you how many pounds we'd make because that's commercially
confidential information.
Anyway, so I think that's it. We've had a great episode, and who knows what's next, because we haven't recorded it yet. But who knows, it'll be something
it's
good.
It's coming up.
All right. Oh no, I think the next episode is the Pride episode.
No, I think it is actually. You are
Pride
right.
Episode. That's so, happy one. Pride, everybody. Enjoy. Be yourself. Be marvelous and go in peace.
Thank you.